Today, Thursday, December 25th, Free Speech Radio News brings you a special holiday documentary.
The year 2008 has been an historic year. The country turned out in huge numbers to elect its first black president. And many see this as the beginning of a new era in this country for racial equality. But 2008 is also a year of remembering a climactic time in U.S. history. It marks the 40th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. Reactionary events shaped the subsequent decades. After Dr. King's death, riots broke out across the country, and in Washington, D.C., angry and distraught citizens burnt much of the city. Racial tensions in the nation's capital persisted well beyond those dramatic years of the Civil Rights Movement. As Washington, D.C. commemorates the year 1968 as a defining moment, youth media organization Radio Roots and the youth organizing group Youth Education Alliance take a look at a rich history of positive social movements in D.C. led by D.C. youth. We'll hear about youth organizing to improve their school lunch program and youth who acted to change perceptions of Salvadoran immigrants. But first, we begin by hearing about youth who in the 1960s did something groundbreaking. They started a teen dance show. The impact went far beyond music and dance and began to alter the perception black youth had of themselves. Margaret Parker, Donna Campbell, Anita Guze, Ariel Holloway, and Markeith Barnes kick off the series with a look at the teen dance show that challenged the status quo within the television industry. All aboard!
If you've seen Soul Train and the movie Hairspray, those productions will give you a good idea of what Teenorama, DC's own 60s teen dance show, was about. The show is a part of the history of DC's hand dance. For those who don't know about hand dance, it's a variation of Chicago stepping, Detroit ballroom, and swing that involves gliding footwork and constant hand contact with a partner. 10 years ago, Beverly Lindsay Johnson produced a documentary about the history of DC hand dance, which led to the production of Dance Party, the Teenorama story.
In doing the documentary, which was called Swing, Bop, and Hand Dance, as I was talking to people or residents of the District of Columbia about how they learned how to hand dance, people started telling me about this show on that used to be on television called the Teenorama Dance Party, and that it came on an all-black television station, WOOK, Channel 14. It doesn't exist now, but back in the 60s, the TV station was like the first station in the nation to program for the black audience. The Teenorama Dance Party show was the jewel of the community. It was a way of seeing black people on television, which at that time, black people were rarely seen on television. And so when black people were on television, it was like, you know, the best thing on earth. It was like going to get an ice cream cone. Even when I was a young girl, whenever, you know, we would know that, like, the Supremes or the Temptations or James Brown or someone like that was going to be on television, I mean, you just called everybody up and said, you got to watch TV, you know, because somebody black was going to be on television. And so with this, the Teenorama Dance Party was a respectable show. It showcased some of the best teenagers in the Washington, D.C. area. It showcased their dance talents. It showcased well-behaved, well-looking young people. And so it became the pride of Washington, D.C.
Washington was a very vibrant black community. many businesses were owned by African Americans. Despite the lack of black ownership in radio and television, Washington's African American community could lay ownership to a popular radio station called WOOK. Eventually, from WOOK, W-O-O-K, came the Teenorama Dance Party.
The kids would talk about the music at that time, talk about what was going on in the schools, the football games, or, you know, the dances, or whatever was going on in the schools around the District of Columbia. They would choose, like, a record of the day, and in the other studio, the teenagers would be dancing to the music that the teenagers were choosing to be played on the radio. So it was very, very popular. And so the radio station put in for a license to become a TV station. And when the license was granted, you know, it was like what they call a no-brainer to move the Teenorama radio show into the visual, which would be the Teenorama Dance Party television show. And that's what they did.
So that's how Teenorama was born. A small purple building located at 5321 First Place, Northeast Washington, D.C., 20011. Here is where the Teenorama Dance Party took place.
From the beginning, I started on radio first, then transitioned to TV. Mm-hmm. I came on when it became a TV show.
Reginald Luckett, also known as Lucky, was one of the teens in the Teenorama show. Lucky would screen teenagers as they would come to the show and make sure that they were wearing the right clothes. He had to make sure the guys had on ties and the girls did not wear short skirts. He worked very closely with the producers of the show, and he was one of the teenage dancers himself. Since Teenorama featured top music celebrities like James Brown and Diana Ross, Lucky will oftentimes help get the entertainers from the Howard Theater to perform on Teenorama.
It was exciting because we were meeting the entertainers of that day, and a little bit different than today. The musicians and the entertainers today make much more money. The entertainers back then weren't riding in limousines and all the glitter that you see now. Well, they were just beginning to bloom into all of that kind of success. Donna Ross and Supreme, now you know Donna Ross is somewhat of a diva now, but Donna Ross was just Donna Ross, you know, and they were trying to, sometimes we, you know, I had to go and literally pick him up in my father's car. I was 16, 17 years old.
Celebrities back then were like normal people, not like today when we scream for the celebrities. No, just like a normal person walking down the street. However, teens in D.C. would watch the show to learn the latest dances from celebrities and their favorite Teenorama regulars, like the Bugaloo and the Philly Dog.
Oh, geez, the Philly Dog, the monkey. the mashed potatoes, the Boogaloo, yes, the mashed potatoes. James Brown, you put that down real quick. You see when James Brown be doing that little dance and sliding across the floor?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's mashed potatoes. Yeah, James Brown, nobody mess with James on that.
Mashed potatoes, yeah.
However, we did have some prolific dancers on the show, some innovators. We always talk about Cool. His name was Bill Clemens, right? We call him Cool. Michael Goodwin. They were innovators. Some entertainers would have records out like the Monkey. Major Lance wrote and produced the Monkey Time, and it was a very popular song. The irony was when he came to our show, he didn't know how to do the monkey. And so, you know, Cool showed him how to do the monkey. He was from Chicago. So we saw, you know, so we saw ourselves as innovators as much as, so, you know, as they were as entertainers. But we just saw ourselves as peers. And so we had, you know, it was fun. It was absolute fun.
Despite all the success of Teenorama, it only lasted on air from 1963 to 1970. because WOOK TV went through financial problems that eventually led to the closing of the station. Tinarama no longer exists, but the building still stands. The WOOK building is now the home of the Lifehouse Center for Healing and CWA Local 2336. If you would like to get the documentary, check out Dance Party, the Tinarama Story, .com. This is Margaret Parker with Donna Campbell, Anita Guze, Uriel Holloway, and Markeith Barnes, reporting from the capital of hand dance, Washington, D.C.
We're going to stay in the capital of hand dance, but take you to a different time and a different neighborhood, to the Latino community in the 1990s. This was a time in Washington, D.C. when many immigrants were moving into the area, many from El Salvador, a country involved in a brutal civil war. But Salvadorans who escaped the violence in their home country found a hostile environment in Washington, D.C. That hostility escalated into riots. As Radio Roots and Youth Education Alliance teens Josh, Tanisha, Leticia, and Samantha found out, D.C.'s Mount Pleasant neighborhood, now home to many Latinos living side by side D.C.'s young activists, experienced intense growing pains.
Police at this hour are still using tear gas, trying to bring this rebellion in the Mount Pleasant section under control.
It was the fires that made this a most frightening night. The fires that harshly cast a light on the gap here between the people and the police.
This project is about teens getting together and trying to find out what happened during the Mount Pleasant riots of 1991. The Mount Pleasant riots happened in Uptown, D.C. on Mount Pleasant Street. It's considered the heart of D.C.'s Latino immigrant community. We spoke with two community members living in the Mount Pleasant neighborhood at the time, who were actually at the riots. Olivia Ca de Val is originally from Mexico City. She came to D.C. in 1985 and got very involved with the Latino community in Mount Pleasant, especially through working at an art center with young people. Kike Aviles is a native of El Salvador. He immigrated to D.C. in the late 1980s and started doing street theater with youths. He was also in his 20s at the time of the riots. The two of them actually knew each other at the time. Olivia was Kike's mentor.
So on that particular night, it was Cinco de Mayo, the 5th of May, and I was hanging out with a bunch of friends at my house down on 16th and Fuller. Or somebody showed up and said, look, there's stuff happening on Mount Pleasant. Turn the TV on. So we turned the TV on and we started watching this whole thing that was evolving.
The riots, this is late at night, and there's these couple of Salvadoreños who've been out drinking. And a rookie policewoman, she was trying to arrest them because they were drunk. And then a rookie policewoman handcuffed them, from what I understand. There's lots of stories where handcuffs were not handcuffs, but I do understand that he was handcuffed. And apparently she got very nervous and her gun went off. And this young Salvadoran was hurt. And if you live in Mount Pleasant, you know that people that live in the apartments, especially in the summer, it was hot. This was in May. Everybody's, windows open, looking out, and they see down there this poor guy, being wounded, and this police woman down there, so they dash out to see what's happening.
After the first nights of the riots,
the second day I was actually with the kids most of the day, and then around, I would say, 5, 6 p.m., Mount Pleasant started getting tense again. People started bringing the dumpsters, mattresses, anything that could serve as a kind of like a barricade. So people started taking over the street. Community leaders were out. There was not a lot of police presence. And there was a sense that once darkness fell, that something was going to really go down.
It lasted about 3 days, 3-4 days. There was a stage of siege. You had to, after hours, I remember coming home with my ice cream that I just bought. Can't come here. I said, well, what do you mean I can't come here? This is where I live. Well, you can't come here. I said, well, my ice cream's melting.
There are a lot of people, you know, that had prepared from the night before. So people had, like, Molotov cocktails. People had rocks, I mean, piles of rocks. But also the cops prepared, too. I mean, they had columns of cops, you know, in riot gear. I mean, hundreds of them, you know, shooting. So all of Columbia Heights, all of Mount Pleasant, all this area was engulfed in tear gas.
After 3 days, the riots died down. Lots of people had been hurt. Cars, buses, and police cruisers were overturned and lit up in flames. And there was a sense that a lot of anger and pain had been expressed. We asked Olivia and Kike, what were the causes of the riots? They talked to us about how Mount Pleasant was a neighborhood of new immigrants from Central and South America, especially El Salvador, and how tensions with the D.C. police force ran high. Olivia used to work in Centro de Arte, an art center near Mount Pleasant. When she was there, she heard about a lot of perceptions that non-Latinos had of the El Salvadorians coming to D.C.
What are all these people flooding our streets, trying to get our jobs, et cetera, et cetera? Why do they have to come here? It's not a choice. Of everybody that I know that comes from El Salvador, they have had a friend, a parent, a relative that's been killed in El Salvador. They themselves have seen war. I imagine that they, you know, that it came back to them. You know, that those experiences that they were fleeing from, that they leave scars in your mind, they leave scars in your heart.
Kike was one of those young Salvadorians that was forced to flee his country because of the war.
The reason that why Salvadorians are here is because the United States was sending 1.2 million a day to El Salvador to keep the military machine alive down there so that American interests could be protected, you know, and that was the excuse. People were dying and people were fleeing, and that's how we ended up here. You know, I always tell people, when your house is on fire, what do? You run. So our house was on fire. We ran, and somehow we ended up over here.
In the anger and fear that the Salvadorian community felt in El Salvador immigrated with them to the U.S., these feelings intensified when that community experienced similar treatment from the police forces in D.C. as they did in their home country.
So then we become immigrants, and then there's all this same thing that is kind of like similar, you know, where the cops are after you, people treating you like you're some type of nobody, you know, not respecting your rights, harassing you, locking you up. And the kids were pissed, you know. So that was the parallel, I think, you know, of El Salvador and here. And people were just sick and tired of being, you know, stopped, of being harassed, of being, you know, frisked, of being locked up.
You know, when you come from Latin America, you don't trust policemen. They mistreat you always. This is something that we all, you know, come from Mexico. You come here and you're already very distrustful of anybody who's a policeman. Policemen are also very, at that time, I can't say, you know, across the board, but the policemen were the law, and they felt that they had to, you know, they had all this growing population they didn't know what to do with. Many of them did not speak Spanish. So I think communications were not always very good.
17 years after the riots, there are still questions concerning what kind of impacts the riots had on Mount Pleasant neighborhood. Olivia said that the riots forced the city to be aware of the problems that were going on for the Latinos in D.C. at the time. This eventually led the city to form a civil rights commission to look and see what civil rights were being violated in the Latino community.
And I will never forget going to some of these hearings. And it's the first time that I had seen in a very official place all these Latino women, Latino men being asked for their opinion. I think this is the time that the Latino community started feeling like they might have some rights in this community. It was almost like a cultural rights that they were gaining because of this.
But Kike has a different point of view. He says that after the riots, changes in the neighborhood had a negative impact on low-income people of color.
Gentrification has kind of set in. And since Mount Pleasant got its historical district certification, you know, once it was declared a historic district, of course, you know, your property values go up, right? So they got that. But then I think that there was always a desire, and it's still to this day even more so, to get rid of all the scum, us.
Many of the rioters were young Salvadorians. Kike doesn't believe that there were significant gains for youth of color in the Mount Pleasant riots. But he does think it was an important event because of what the community demonstrated about how they were being treated.
On that day, a lot of them started relating, and a lot of the stuff started coming out as to, like, why people felt that they needed to do what they did. So a lot of the resentment, a lot of the anger, a lot of the complaints, a lot of this, just like people being really pissed about how the cops had been behaving for a long time towards young people, was really coming out.
After much hard work from all the teens that participated to make this possible, we want to say thank you to everyone. And we hope you enjoy listening to this as much as we enjoy making it. This project was produced by Josh, Letitia, Tanisha, and Samantha. I'm your special guest, Anita, with the Youth Educational Alliance and Radio Roots, reporting from Mount Pleasant, D.C.
So now we've heard about youth organizing in Washington, D.C. in the 50s and in the 90s, periods during which there were many negative stereotypes about youth of color. Today, it's fair to say that negative depictions of youth still permeate some news coverage and entertainment media. Many youth and their allies say these continued stereotypes are unfair, especially since there had always been youth working to better the lives of themselves and others. Let's travel now to this decade and introduce you to some of those contemporary youth organizing around issues important to them, including youth employment, HIV/AIDS, and school lunches. Radio Roots trainer and producer Selena Masuda profiles two youth who have worked for change in Washington, D.C.
Change is pretty much in the hands of the youth.
That's 19-year-old Robert Gorham. At the age of 13, Gorham worked with a D.C.-based community health organization called Metro Teen AIDS as a peer educator. His goal? Support young people in the fight against HIV and AIDS. After 2 years of educating young people on HIV and other STD prevention methods with Metro Teen AIDS, one of the adult staff introduced Gorham to the work of a youth-led organization, the Youth Education Alliance, or YEA.
It was different from Metro Teen AIDS. You know, Metro Teen AIDS talk about STDs and, you know, AIDS and HIV within the city, and YEA talks about education and how we can better education. And for me, it was like, yo, it was a new challenge.
YEA trains youth to develop campaigns around issues that matter to them, and they take their campaigns to the school system, the D.C. City Council, straight to spheres of influence. YEA members used a list of how-tos they learned through the organization, including effective methods of outreach, facilitating meetings, and talking to public officials to further their personal causes. One issue at the top of the youth's agenda? School lunches.
Why do these, like, Maryland schools and private schools and, you know, charter schools have different options as far as whether they want chicken or, you know, tuna? For the vegetarians, they have a salad bar. Like, why can't we have the same thing?
While a student at Eastern Senior High School, Gorham was disgusted by the quality of the food that the school offered. Gorham describes the school lunches in most D.C. public schools as gross and unhealthy, practically inedible.
You had, like, rotten or, like, dag on there, rotten or old salad and, like, old fruit, and sometimes your milk would be spoiled. Your French fries would be all soggy and stuff. So it was pretty nasty. Of course, people ate it because, like, you know, we pretty much doesn't have anything else to eat. Then some people just ate from the snack machines.
Gorham and other Yay members took their complaints as well as their better lunch program ideas to the city council, the DC Public School officials, to anyone that could make a decision about their food needs. They encountered a lot of resistance at first.
When we started talking to some of the officials, it's like their response is just like, but it's healthy, you know what I'm saying? Or we like, no, we need like a full, like we were telling them like we need a full nutrition, and it's like, well, you know, like we need like a meat, a vegetable, and you know, like well balanced and like good milk and stuff like that. But their response would be like, well, French fries is a vegetable, but like of course after you fry it, you know, it pretty much takes all the nutrients and stuff out. But then like they made a decision to actually bake the fries, which was even worse because it was healthy but it was soggy. So it was like, ew.
Most of Ye's requests were not implemented at the time, but 2 years after the campaign, DCPS is currently implementing a new food policy that may include outsourcing food services to provide better choices for students. Gorham is not the only youth in town working to change things for the better. The Youth Action Research Group, or YARG, have been working on a campaign to win better summer youth employment opportunities from the city. Last summer, they spent most of their time developing strategies that would force city officials to take their concerns seriously, says 18-year-old Christian Moreno.
We've been looking to expand summer youth employment opportunities for DC youth, summer pay rates for youth, all-around jobs for youth, basically anything around youth employment and youth issues. We've been working, like I said, to get pay raised, to get the program extended, to try to be year-long, more year-round slots and stuff. And we've been meeting with a lot of council members and working a lot on policy and stuff with them and asking them to do stuff for us, like increase the budget.
DC's Summer Youth Employment Program has grown from 5,000 to 15,000 participants in recent years. Despite the growth of the program, it has been plagued with problems. The program has failed to pay teens on time, and employers have been accused of treating teen employees unfairly on the job site without any oversight by the city's Summer Youth Employment Program. YARG organizers have succeeded in raising the pay rate from $5.15 to $5.65 per hour this summer, as well as many other recommendations. But the summer of 2008 proved problems continued to exist around payment and treatment of employees. Christian Moreno and 19-year-old Corey Price, another member of YARG, say that the city should better check in on summer youth employers.
They need to keep an eye on them. Basically just keep on dipping in every day, every other day about how they're treating the workers and how they're paying them. Just stay on them.
They need to be held accountable for how they treat the youth and pay the youth. They need to be held accountable for that because the experiences that they give us now will lead to the experiences that we have in the future, the impact that we will make on the future. So if they treat us like criminals in the present, we might as well just turn out into criminals and it'll come back on them. So we will act the way you treat us.
The Youth Action Research Group and the Youth Education Alliance are just a few of the youth-led organizations in D.C., which youth have become players in D.C.'s decision-making and political process. For Radio Roots, with Makeda Sheffield and Monica Jones, I am Selena Masuda.
You've been listening to a youth-produced documentary by Radio Roots in Washington, D.C. Free Speech Radio News is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments at fsrn.org. Production and technical assistance by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Jose, Puck Lowe, and Rose Kadopchi. I'm Leanne Caldwell in Washington, D.C. Thanks for tuning in on this December 25th, 2008.